Hello and welcome to our food principles module of the NEPT course. I'm so very excited to be here to share with you this information. It's a passion of mine. Food has always been a passion of mine, and when I can have the opportunity to do a presentation that ties together food and biochemistry and how it affects the body, I get really excited. I've been calling this module different things in the back end when I'm talking to my team, and they're like, "What's the real title of this conversation you're having here?" And it's Food Principles is the official title, but beyond food principles, I like to talk about diet dogma and food religions. So we're going to talk about some basic food principles here, and we're going to share an overview in this presentation of the various food plans. Let's say I call them food religions, and sometimes I call it diet dogma. And we're going to talk about each of those different pieces and the pros and the cons and when you should use them, so you feel really good about helping someone design a diet that works for them, for where they are right now, but also that you can merge and meld and form that for where they get to be in the future. So, before we get fully started, in this and all presentations that I do and that you do with your clients, when you're talking about food and food as medicine, food as healing, you just want to be careful from a legal standpoint that you're always clear with them that what you're giving them is education so that they get to make the decision, the final decision about what they do. And if they're under the care of a doctor, they're being treated for any kind of disease or disease process, or they're taking medication of any kind, that they need to check in with the doctor that the foods that they're doing are not going to interfere with the action of the medication. But ultimately, the decision is theirs as to what they do. They need to inform their doctor because the kinds of things that you can do with food that we're going to discuss in this and future presentations within this particular module are so profound that it changes the need for medication. It changes the dosages that people need, and a lot of times people can get off medication altogether. But you don't say that to people. There's no promises, and of course, it's all up to them and working with their doctor. So I just want to share that with you, and I share that over and over with you. I love this ancient Ayurvedic proverb. If the diet is wrong, medicine is of no use. If the diet is correct, medicine is of no need. I was first introduced to this quote actually by my now 22-year-old son when he was probably about 16, and he sent me a copy. He took a picture on his cell phone of this plaque that was hanging up at one of our favorite restaurants in town, which is a macrobiotic restaurant. And he said, "Mom, I think you'll like this." And it makes sense because, right, people try to look for medicine to fix them, medicine to heal them. But if their diet is wrong, that medicine isn't going to do any good. The medicine might temporarily relieve symptoms, it might apply a band-aid, but it's not going to do them any real good. If the diet is correct, medicine is of no need because when the diet, and loosely diet, but you know, it's diet and attitude and the stress and all the pillars that we talk about, when it's correct, basically people are healthy. It activates the inner healer. I mean, certainly not 100% either way, but I think it's something that I love to live by, and I really love to empower my patients and my clients to make their choices about what they put in their body, what the thoughts they put in their head, what they put on their skin, to optimize and activate their inner healer. These are a couple of quotes I like to share with you that you might share with your clients, but these came from my clients. Nothing tastes as good as healthy feels. So you may love the McDonald's diet. You may love the Baskin and Robbins ice cream diet, but those diets don't necessarily love you back. And the feeling of being healthy, of waking up every day with energy and a body that performs well, without pain, comfort, it's not worth any amount of taste on the tongue. And literally, what people do is they put the food on their tongue, it's there for 30 seconds, they put some more in. Over time, it's maybe there for 20 minutes. So, 20 minutes of pleasure for hours and days and weeks. So, I like to reinforce that with my clients, my patients, that really think about it, what you're trading when you're trading that delight on your tongue from the M&Ms for however long. What is it actually doing in your body? And those are the things we educate people about. So these diets that we're going to be talking about in this module are diets that are restrictive in a way. They're going to be removing a lot of the foods that people have been come to associate with comfort, with joy. But they're going to put other things back in, and there's no reason that a healthy diet, a diet that's consistent with a person's physiology and biochemistry, has to taste bad. And many of you that come through this program have backgrounds in food education, as chefs, as instructors, and you know that you can make all the healthy foods taste absolutely delicious. And then this other one, one of my clients said this to me. She said she puts this on her wall, and she said, don't exchange what you want in the moment for what you want the most. So we want to empower our clients, our patients, to make choices about what they put in their mouth, how they live their lives, based on how they desire to feel, based on what they want the most. And what more telling or what more appropriate module to be pulling this out in but a food religion module, a food principles. This is all about the basic food principles. And I'm going to say right up front, right for the record, that I don't believe that there's any one diet that's perfect for every person. That's dogma. That's diet dogma. And we have the aficionados of specific diets that say their diet is the best. And I believe that the best diet is the diet that, number one, the person is going to follow, that, number two, supplies all their nutritional needs, and number three, does not introduce excess toxicity, and number four, that they can derive pleasure from. Because, I mean, truthfully, pleasure is not the main goal of food. But that's where everybody's come from. They've come from a point of, let's celebrate, let's go get ice cream, let's celebrate, let's go get pizza. Okay, so we're starting this module off. Like I said, this is the first video in a series of some number, probably at least 10, that are going to go through and dig deep into the diets. And I say this loosely, that the number, because I go through and I'm creating all this material, but then, oh, what about this one? Oh, what about this one? Oh, this one needs a separate video. So it's very fun to put this together, and I hope that you find it as fun to learn as I. The diet can create balance or all-out war. And our jobs as doctors, as nurses, as nutrition coaches, as health coaches, is to help our patients and clients keep the time bombs off their dinner plates, to make the food that they're eating be consistent with their physiology. So what we're going to go through over the course of these particular videos is really digging deep in the variety of different diet plans that you can be choosing and helping your client to incorporate and customizing for them so that they enjoy the food and the food enjoys them, the body enjoys the food as well. So it's like they have to have this mutual respect for each other. And we're going to talk about ways that you can not just learn these diet principles, but when to apply them and when to merge and combine them. So I'm looking at loosely three main diet categories. You've got an animal-based, where animal products are the primary source of nutrition. And of course, they include fruit and vegetables. There are a few that include very few fruit and vegetables, but they really focus on the animal products being the center of the meal. There's plant-based, where plants are the primary source of nutrition, but not necessarily the only source of nutrition. And these can be vegan, where no animal products at all are excluded in the diet. It could be vegetarian, which could be ovo-lacto-vegetarian, lacto-vegetarian, or some people call themselves pescatarians, where they don't eat any meat, but they'll eat eggs or dairy in ovo-lacto. Lacto, which is eggs or just dairy, they don't eat eggs. You can have an ovo-vegetarian, you can have a pesco-vegetarian, etc. And some of them include some animal byproducts like honey, etc. Some eliminate that, okay? Again, when we're talking about this these diets and we want to give a name, a lot of people like to associate with a particular diet. And that's where I start to call it the food religion. What's your food religion? Oh, I'm vegan. Oh, so you can't have this thing with honey in it. Oh, I'm a raw foodist. Oh, well, you can't have the steamed broccoli then. And it becomes so absolute and so rigid that it starts to lose some of the value that people are going to it for. So there's raw food, and some people include some animal products in a raw food diet, like raw milk or eggs, or raw meat, sushi, things like that. But there are people who just eat raw food that's not necessarily vegan. It's raw foods with animal products. There's fruitarian, people who just eat fruit. Then there's the mixed. There's people who eat primarily plants, but they have either a small portion of some sort of animal product on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, on a monthly basis, either because it's social or cultural or because they feel better that way. And so when we're working with creating people's diets for them, we have to really tune in, not just on their health needs, but on the cultural background, upon the social environment, and what they're actually going to stick with. And we want to make the best possible diet that we can for them that they're going to stick with. And it doesn't mean compromising. It doesn't mean that if you really feel like a certain food category needs to be eliminated for this person and they're not wanting to do it, that you can tell them, hey, well, that's okay. We can do some other things and get you the results. That they have to make a conscious decision. Like, look, if you're not willing to remove this category of food, then these are the results. And this is the lack of results we might be able to get. And we'll dig more deeply into this in the philosophy of putting together these food plans for people as we go through. And then the third category I loosely put in there was breatharian. Now, there are folks who claim that they just live on prana, on energy. They don't eat and they don't drink. I have met some of them, and the one that I met said, well, you know, occasionally I go out with my friends and have a cup of coffee and maybe I'll have a donut with them, but most of the time I don't eat. But so I don't know. You know, I don't know, is there anybody who truly is going through their life and not eating anything at all and hasn't for some length of time, right? I mean, yeah. So that's something that we're not going to explore in here because it's not an area that I have the interest to explore, but it's also not the area that I have the expertise to explore. More power to you. I wish I could be a breatharian because, wow, I wouldn't get hungry. I wouldn't need to eat. I wouldn't have to deal with it. I just breathe and do yoga, and that's how I supply myself. I would love that because it's just a lot of work to have to make food. On the other hand, if being a breatharian means that you're going around feeling hungry all the time and lightheaded and starving, well, that's not good either. Anyway, that's enough on breatharian. That's the last you're going to hear of it exactly from me. So let's look at some other things. Let's look at some of the basics and the goals of putting together a healing diet for someone. So the first goal is going to be to remove the offending foods and substances. And there are certain offending foods and substances that are the same for everybody. You know, certain things, no matter what, people should avoid, like sugar and oxidized fats and trans fats and pesticides and things like that. We want to remove those things. But then there's other things that are going to vary. And all the diets that we'll be going through, we'll talk a lot more about those particular quote-unquote offending foods and substances. Because one person's poison is another person's substance, right? And there may be certain components and constituents that we'll get into that are not working for someone's physiology at this particular point in time, and it may change over time. So it must be customized for their specific health issues. And we, you know, that's the whole beauty of doing a full health history to determine what does this person need? What is their family history? What are their particular issues right now? Do they need an anti-inflammatory diet? Do they need a very alkaline diet? Do they need to have a high protein diet to heal from a particular injury? What are their issues and what are some of the things they need to turn to food for? It needs to provide systemic support via nutrient-rich foods. It just needs to supply their daily requirement for substances the body can't make, the vitamins, the minerals, and some of the antioxidants to protect from the endotoxins that we make as a result of metabolic processing, but also the exotoxins, those from outside, from the environment that we live in. So it has to supply that systemic support. It has to consist of whole, organic, unprocessed foods, organic as much as possible. Totally impossible to go 100% organic unless you're living in a place where you can be self-sufficient and you can grow your own food 100% of the time in a pristine environment. But we target, right? There's not perfection, right? We're looking for progress, not perfection. And we're looking for good, better, best, as Tony likes to say. So what else? Well, we need to include good fats in that. A lot of folks are going, the fat is bad, fat is evil, we need to stay away from fat. And then they're excluding fat to the point where their hormones get out of balance, they get depressed, their nervous system gets out of balance, their skin gets dry and flaky. Good fats. We'll talk about that as time progresses. Needs to contain some source of probiotic-rich foods. The organisms that live in our gut sustain the whole rest of the body. And almost all cultures contain a traditional food that is probiotic-rich. It's us in the Western world where we've gotten away from that. And a lot of the probiotic-rich foods came about as a result of not having the refrigeration it just happens that way. We have the refrigeration, so we figure we don't need it. But we need to constantly be replenishing our critters. So probiotic rich foods, we'll talk more about that later. Balanced biochemistry so that more foods are tolerated. This is key because a lot of times we're going to see people who they just can't tolerate a lot of foods. They've developed so many food sensitivities and allergies that they've just eliminated so many things. And yeah, they can go through life eating these same five foods, but they'll probably develop a sensitivity to those too. So the goal is not just to remove the offending foods and to remove the things that people are sensitive to, but it's to balance the biochemistry, heal the gut, heal the digestion so that they can tolerate more and more foods. Not so they can go back and eat Cheetos again, not so that they could get their fill of M&Ms, but so that they can be incorporating this plethora of very healthy, very, very nutrient-dense foods. And a lot of the people we're seeing are so depleted and so debilitated and their guts are such a mess that they don't even tolerate the good stuff anymore. And that can be scary, and we really want to avoid that. It's got to have variety. Because those diets that are same old, same old, same old every day. Do you ever work with somebody like that where they just eat the same exact things every day? My mother-in-law was one of those. She would have her Cheerios and her milk in the morning with a half a grapefruit and some toast. That was her breakfast. And maybe she didn't have the toast all the time. And then on weekends, she had variety. She'd have bacon and eggs and toast. During the day, she'd have a banana and a glass of milk, and for dinner, she had whatever. You know, it wasn't a lot of variety. She didn't have a lot of nutrients flowing in a wide variety of foods. And it's really important because the variety, number one, people get bored, they get sick. So if you give them a menu plan for a week and you say, okay, just do this every week, they're not going to like that all too much, okay? But if you give them a menu plan for 6 weeks or a month or 2 months, then they can do some variation. They can actually vary it. But the other reason for variety is nutrient distribution. We want to have a lot of the colors, a lot of the shapes, a lot of the families of foods so that they're getting a wide variety of nutrients. So in general, these are foods that support healing, and not just necessarily support health, but support people in their healing. And most of the people that we see are not just here to get healthier or to prevent things. A lot of them are seeing us because they want to overcome their hormone imbalance, their gut imbalance, their headaches, whatever. So for most people, and we'll talk about exceptions to this and when some of the green leafy vegetables need to be limited, but green leafy vegetables are a food group that most Western diet people do not eat a lot of. They get a little piece of lettuce on their on their sandwich. They may have a small salad, mostly iceberg lettuce. They don't get a variety of green leafy vegetables. And then maybe they have spinach. A lot of times it's from a can or frozen. So green leafy vegetables, you know this. And low glycemic fruits. Why low glycemic? Well, we'll talk more in detail when we do the low glycemic diet section. And you know how we want to keep the blood sugar steady. Steady. Brassica vegetables loaded with indole-3 carbinols and diindole methanes and sulforaphanes and so many things that are protective that if person tolerates, we want to give them and get them on them. Same thing with sea vegetables, loaded with minerals, loaded with iodine, which is deficient in most soils. And in spite of the fact that a lot of people are fearful about iodine because they think it's going to impact hurt the thyroid or the thyroid if there's Hashimoto's, there's a lot of issues, and we'll look at some of that in more detail. Omega-3 fats. Most people have a lot of omega-6 fats, a lot of saturated fats, but very little omega-3. And so we want to make sure they have good sources of unheated omega-3 fats, because once you heat them, they get destroyed. Coconut, and it should say coconut more than coconut oil, but the reason I said coconut oil is because in healing, so many people with nervous system disorders and with gut disorders, the oils in the coconut can be so healing. The medium chain triglycerides have been found to be so helpful for nervous system health, for folks with MS, for folks with seizures, for folks with Alzheimer's. The caprylic acid and the lauric acid are antimicrobial. Caprylic especially important for candida and fungal overgrowths, and the lauric acid for viruses. So the coconut has this. Mysteric acid, which is another one of the oils in coconut, which is super important for actually helping the omega-3s, the short chain ones in things like chia, flax, and hemp, and walnuts, to convert into the longer chain EPA and DHA. So coconut can be a godsend. Raw nuts and seeds, preferably germinated. So preferably you take the raw nuts and seeds, you rinse them, you put them in a bowl, you let them soak, you rinse them again. And in some cases, you can actually let them sprout a small tail, and you've germinated them, you've activated them, and they're much more healing and protective of the gut and the rest of the body. If a person tolerates grains at all, they need to be whole and non-gluten in a healing phase. And for the majority of people, going without gluten is important. We have a whole module on gluten. Probiotic and prebiotic rich foods. We talked about that earlier. And there's so many of these. Prebiotics feed the probiotic organisms. Probiotic just keep replenishing them. And some of the things that we want to incorporate, like culturally, it varies, but kefir and Rejuvelac, sauerkraut and coconut yogurt, cashew yogurt, almond yogurt, whatever kind of yogurt you want to make, nut and seed yogurts of all sorts, Jerusalem artichoke, and chicory root are the prebiotics. So these are things that support healing. Garlic, onions, mushrooms, these are really super important, especially the shiitakes and maitakes, which you can actually now get at the supermarket. Maitakes you can easily find dried, and they're a great addition to people, and they're great healers, especially when you combine those mushrooms with the sea vegetables. They provide a lot of the nutrients that the gut needs to repair, a lot of those collagen synthesis nutrients. Herbs and spices are friends to your clients, and they have so much therapeutic value, from the anti-inflammatories in turmeric and ginger and cumin, and the antimicrobials in oregano and thyme, and the depression, the mood lifting effects, and the liver support of rosemary and basil, and the adrenal support that all of these offer. And there's so many more, and people can just freely use these herbs and spices, and really encourage them to do. And one of the things that's super important is lecithin, and I like sunflower because it's not from soy. So this is just some of the foods that support healing, and we'll go through a whole module on healing foods and how do you create a healing diet for different kinds of conditions. Foods that inhibit healing. These are pretty well established and well agreed upon, and there are more, And for each individual, there's going to be other things that are interfering with their healing. If somebody has a severe allergy to spinach and they eat a lot of spinach, that's going to inhibit their healing. So know that there's these foods that are pretty much filled with anti-health nutrient or components, and others that are just going to be bad based on person's physiology. So charbroiled meat, heterocyclic amines, these are very difficult to metabolize and break down and eliminate toxins that are in charred meat. Some say that a piece of charbroiled steak has as much of a particular toxin as 200 cigarettes. I don't know. I haven't verified that. It was just a hearsay thing. But the point is that heterocyclic amines are very, very difficult for the body to detoxify and eliminate. And as the more and more we look at the SNPs, at the single nucleotide polymorphisms, when it comes to genetics, we see a lot of people have impairment in those pathways, that those pathways may not be fully up to speed. So eliminating, avoiding. The processed high glycemic foods that are just predominating in people's diets, flour, sugar, grains. And the people that come to see you who are saying, well, I'm on a healthy diet, I only eat whole grain flour. Well, personally, I think any kind of flour is a prescription for disaster in anybody that has any health issues. Sure, an occasional in somebody who's healthy is not a big deal, but even your whole grain rice flour, because it's when it's down in that way, the little tiny particles, it gets broken down into sugar so quickly. We have salivary amylase in our mouths, remember? Salivary amylase will break the starch down and start to convert it to sugar. And so if you're eating flour products, a lot of that starts to turn to sugar right in your mouth. And most flour products contain sugar, so you have a double whammy. And then grains for some folks, but processed grains, you know, whole grains are not necessarily bad for everybody, but a lot of people don't have the ability to handle the disaccharides and the various saccharides in them. And we'll talk about that more when we talk about the specific carbohydrate and FODMAPs and things like that. Chemical-laden foods, you know, who really, if you can't pronounce it, don't put it in your mouth. And it's amazing how many foods have these petrochemicals in them. Excess alcohol, right? And excess is key. In someone who's sick, probably any alcohol is not good. In someone who is well and has an occasional sip, probably not as bad, depending on their genes again, depending on how they are wired. And personally, alcohol for me is bad. Okay, I'll have alcohol in my tincture, in my echinacea tincture, but that's it. I don't drink because I don't want that those pathways activated because of some of the gut genes, especially that I have. Caffeine, there's a lot of people really pushing through that, go through the bulletproof coffee, go to the longevity coffee where the funguses are not in there and they're really high quality, and a lot of people are getting addicted to it. So, yeah, again, if somebody has an occasional cup of coffee that's organic and it's brewed and there's not a whole lot of sugar and everything else added to it, that's one thing. But when you have to have it every day, when they say, oh, I have to have my coffee every day, I can't go without it, you know that the body is not making energy well enough on its own and they need the caffeine to keep them going. So that's a controversial one. A lot of these are controversial. The alcohol and the caffeine are controversial. You've got the, oh yeah, you can eat the Mediterranean diet and all that. Anyway, that's it. So hydrogenated oxidized fats across the board, I don't think anybody will tell you that those are good for you. And those are fats that have either been artificially altered in the lab or by the addition of the hydrogenation to make them more saturated, or they've been oxidized by heat or air or light. And all of those things are damaging to fat. Foods in cans and plastics, right? A lot of those cans leach. Now, they're now coming up with inert-lined cans, but that's not the average. And plastic, as soon as it gets above a certain temperature, it starts to break down and leach those xenoestrogens and endocrine disruptors into the food. And finally, allergens and inflammatory foods, gluten and dairy and whatever they're allergic to, but I put gluten and dairy because they top our list. So this isn't inclusive, all-inclusive, and we're going to be going through and delving deeper into each of these pieces of the diet or the specific diet religions, as I call them. All right, so let's look at the food religions. What are some of the food religions? And there are more, and I'll mention them as well. But the ones that you hear a lot about are the macrobiotics. Macrobiotics is of Asian descent. It comes from Michio Kushi and some other people who, and the whole purpose of macrobiotics is balance, eating foods that keep your physiology balanced, that keep expansive foods, contractive foods, hot foods, cold foods, dry foods, wet foods, and finding that balance that works for each individual person. The way that macrobiotics, at least, is taught here in the States and is written about, it's very high in rice, very high in grain. But that doesn't mean that you can't pull good principles from it. Now, some people thrive on that and do really well, and some people don't because all that grain and it's a high glycemic and it can affect gut bugs. So there's a lot of amazing principles in macrobiotics, and we'll have a whole module on macrobiotics. But how to know, how can you pull some of those principles and use them with your clients, right? How do you find that diet that's not too hot, not too cold, right? How do you vary it from season to season? You don't want to take somebody who tends to run hot and is having hot flashes and it's the middle of summer and put them on hot soup. It's just counterproductive to what their body really needs. So it's tuning in, and it's using the sour foods, the fermented foods, the sea vegetables in ways that are beautiful. Putting together a true balanced macrobiotic meal is an art form. And I was working with someone many years ago, and I was helping her put together meals. It was a neighbor, and she was diagnosed with cancer, and she lived next door, and I kept making her meals and bringing them over, and she really wanted these macrobiotic meals. So I was working on it. It was a lot of work to put all those components together, but it can be a very healing diet, and you can take components of it to help you put together a program for the people that you're working with. Ayurvedic diets are based on the concept, again, of biochemical individuality, and they have three what they call doshas, the vata, pitta, and the kapha. And you take a questionnaire and you figure out what dosha you belong to. But think about it, all the billions of people in the world, we're not going to be able to categorize them into three boxes. It just isn't the case. So, but it gives you an idea of where you lean towards, and you can get an idea of how to adapt that. With the Ayurvedic diet, there's the concept of vata, which are the thin, wiry people, and they're moving a lot and they're frenetic. And there's the people, there's the pitta, who are supposed to be more solid and muscular, but lean and fiery. And then the kapha, who are more like there and like foundational and robust. And but there's different diets and different foods and different herbs that you would adapt to. It's a complicated science. You can get a book on it and learn a whole lot more. But the thing is, you've got to not take these as religions. You take them as guidelines, and you can pick and choose the principles from each one that is going to work best for each client. With Ayurvedic, I tell a story about how I went to a conference years ago with David Winston, who was one of my mentors, and he had this wonderful conference. And we were there for 6 days learning all about his herbal stuff. And every day we were in the kitchen, like helping with making meals and eating meals together. And I remember most people were eating a lot. There were a lot of cooked foods, and I didn't eat a lot of cooked foods. I still don't eat a lot of cooked foods. I mostly eat my raw foods. And so I was mostly doing salads, and there was plenty for me to eat. But I remember a woman coming up to me, who was an Ayurvedic practitioner, and she said, "But you've got a lot of vata in you. You shouldn't be eating all those raw foods. It's not good for you." And I just kind of looked at her, and she wasn't the healthiest looking person in the world. I mean, people have to, like, I really take offense when somebody tells me that my diet's not working for them, and I look at them and go, "Well, yours doesn't look like it's working for you either." But I took offense, like, "Well, you don't know me. How could you say that to me?" Well, I held my tongue, and I was like, "Well, okay. But it works for me. I've been doing this for 25 years, and I'm fit, I'm lean. I've been getting up every morning before anybody else, and I'm going out for a 6 mile run, and I'm energized and I feel great. Like, why would I want to change this?" But she was going by, well, the principles of Ayurvedic, you shouldn't be doing it. Same thing with macrobiotics. You shouldn't be eating too much fruit or too much raw food. You've got to figure it out for yourself, and you got to help your clients to figure it out for them. So it's when you go into one of these and go, I do the macrobiotics, or I do Ayurvedic, or I do Weston Price, that you don't see the benefits and the beauty in all of it. And it starts out, sometimes people have diet wars. It's kind of like the religious wars. It's like, my God's better than your God. My food's better than your food. And we really have to look at all the whole foods and figuring out ways to put it together for each individual person. I like the way Dr. Gabriel Cousins talks about the Ayurvedic in his book, Conscious Eating. And he talks about how they just don't believe in a lot of raw foods. And Gabriel Cousins is very much into eating living foods. And he adapted the recipes with the spices and the particular foods for each of the doshas to a more whole plant-based diet. And it works well. And so there's a lot of ways that you can take the basics, take the principles of the balance and how to look at person's physiology and their moods, etc., and decide what they can be eating. And then use a different variety. Use your palate, so to speak, of your foods. I love it. The Weston Price was based on a dentist that traveled around, and then he looked at cultures. He looked at primitive cultures who hadn't been just kind of distorted by our food, our food industry that's just so alluring in these non-food foods, right? So he studied and he laid out, like, all these people had these various components. It's a diet that's pretty high in meat and animal fats, and those are considered to be, those fats are considered to be like the staple. And so the way I've heard, and I don't know if this is true of the entire movement, but the way I've heard Sally Fallon, who wrote a book called Nourishing Traditions, speak about it is like, yeah, vegetables are good. They're good as carriers for fat. So the modern day Weston Price people are pushing people to have a lot of fat in the way of lard and tallow and, you know, this is processed food. When you take a fat away from the food, I don't care, why is a fat taken away from a food any better than a starch taken away from a food? So, for example, we look at white flour being not a whole food because we've taken away the germ and the bran. I think oils are like that. And there are times to use oils therapeutically, but I think that whole foods are going to be best. There are times when people's digestion is too compromised, and so you do use the fats if they need them. But the Weston Price diet is a little bit, let's just say, on the side of, I think, too much in the way of animal fat for me and anybody that I've worked with. It may work for some folks. So we'll explore that in more detail. The low-carb diets, there's a lot of them, and I have on the next six of these, I have a separate slide where we'll go through and just overview, discuss some of the various ones in here, and then on a lot of these, we're going to have separate presentations where we can go into the pros and the cons and the specifics and how do you choose what person and when to use it. So we've got the low-carb diets, we've got the plant-based diets, we've got the specific macronutrient ratio diet, so where we're going for specific ratio of carbs to fats to protein. There's diets that are based on the food or religions, if you want, based on the avoidance of particular chemical constituents, like, you know, histamines and oxalates, etc. And then there's hypoallergenic and elimination diet, and finally low glycemic. So we'll go through each of these in a little bit more detail. And again, we're going to have presentations that lump a lot of these together and go into a lot more detail. On the low carb side, we've got things like the Zone, the Atkins, the South Beach. Paleo's there twice. How interesting. Yeah. Anyway, I'm going to note that down. So give me a second. It wasn't there twice on my slide, but Stacy prettied it up. I don't know how that got there, why it's there twice. So it's slide 18, and it's at 39.07. Okay. All right, so let me start again. So, the low carb diet, and I'm going to rearrange because I had it in a particular order and it's not in that order anymore. So, on the low carb diet, we've got things like Atkins, and Atkins was one that, it was the Atkins Revolution. He actually, I think, first wrote his book in the 70s, where the idea is that the carbs are bad. They're low glycemic diet, they're low carbs, but they're not necessarily healthy versions of it. So with the Atkins diet, it's like, okay, as long as you keep your carb, fat, and protein ratios in this range, then keep your carbs under whatever 50 grams a day, that it's okay. But they didn't distinguish with what you can eat in terms of carbs. They didn't do a lot of distinguishing in terms of what you can eat in terms of the meats and the animal products. And they also did not distinguish between organic, pastured, free range, and the regular commercial stuff. So we've got things like the Atkins, the Zone, the South Beach diets, and they're very similar and they have all have a little bit different take on them. The Zone talks a lot about prostaglandins and fat balance. So they talk a lot about getting omega-3s, whereas the Atkins didn't pay much attention to that. But those are the low fat, the low carb diets, and we'll look at those. Paleo is, I put it in with the low carb diet because it is, but paleo is an old new diet, I like to think of it as Paleolithic diet. So the paleo is the diet that our ancestors followed, supposedly, before we had industrialization, before we had refrigeration, before we had trucks that took food from one end of the country to the other, or airplanes that took it. We had to eat locally and we had to eat what was there. So the Paleolithic people ate a lot of roots and berries, and when they could find an animal, they killed it and they ate that, and they went back and ate fruits and berries and greens. The modern paleos, I love this as a diet, except that some people take it as a good excuse to eat bacon. And that's where I fall. I have a hard time with. So, if we really model a modern paleo diet after a true Paleolithic diet, it would look a little bit different than the way most people practice it. So, for example, I love the fact that the paleo diet excludes gluten and dairy and sugar and processed foods. I love that it focuses on good fats like avocados and coconuts, nuts and seeds, and animal products. And they make it a thing like animal products have to be, some of them do, that it has to be at every meal. And really, if you're doing a true paleo diet, you're eating a ton of plants with a little bit of meat. So I actually practice what I call a plant-based paleo, plant-powered paleo. I do all the things that they recommend in paleo, or I eliminate the things. I just don't eat any eggs or animal products. That's my version of it. So you can find your own and find a version for people. But what I do see a lot of times when people say, oh, I'm following paleo and I'm still not feeling better, and I look at what they're eating just lots and lots and lots of meat and eggs. And eggs tend to be in the top six allergens. So you got to be really, really careful about that. Now, autoimmune paleo excludes the eggs. So that might be a little bit better version. And I'm not knocking any of these diets. I'm not knocking paleo at all. What I wanted you to do, and when we go into more details on these, is to see the pros and the cons and how you could take some of the principles from it and allow some of the other principles to go. And then finally, we've got ketogenic, which is the ultimate low carb diet, which is an amazing healing diet. It has some amazing healing for epilepsy, for multiple sclerosis, for autoimmune diseases, for any real inflammatory diseases, especially those that involve the nervous system. They put kids who have epileptic seizures, intractable epileptic seizures, on ketogenic diets, and they see phenomenal results. Ketogenic diet is an extreme low carb, extreme high fat, and that's where it comes from. You cannot do a ketogenic diet that's like, 15 ounces of steak and, some berries and things like that. Ketogenic diet is strict and it's a therapeutic diet. I personally don't think it's meant for long-term use, except in people who have to do it for long-term use. It's been found to be helpful with cancer. So it's really between 70 and 80% fat. There's a certain fat to protein ratio when you're doing it therapeutically correct, and very low carb. And the carb, for some, it's anything below 50 grams a day. For some, they have to go as low as 5 to 10 grams a day. Now, in a 50 gram a day ketogenic diet, you can eat a fair amount of veggie matter, which is cool. You can actually get your vegetables. But if you're trying to limit it to 5 grams a day or 10 grams a day to stay in ketosis, what you're doing is limiting the amount of these antioxidant-rich, vitamin mineral-rich foods that you can take in, because there's very little vegetable that you can take in. And that can create other problems. So I say be careful with ketogenic diets, and help people, if they want to do a ketogenic diet, to do it in the healthiest way they can, where they're getting as much as possible of some of their green leafy vegetables. And again, we'll go into more details. There's a lot of little things. I've helped people design ketogenic diets who are vegan, who did it therapeutically. And what happened in this particular person was that we had great results with the ketogenic, and we had great results with the brain function, and her memory, and everything got better. And then after a while, she started to bite it with her liver. Her liver started to hurt. She started to have elevated liver enzymes because of the extreme level of fat. So we're working with that balance, okay? Do the ketogenic for a while, get that neurologic help, then back off before you start to get the liver involved in getting stressed out, because then the liver has a hard time with detoxifying and doing all its other jobs. And then you go back and you do more of a little bit more protein, carb, more vegetables, maybe vegetable juices for a while, and then go back. And you're going to help people to find what that ideal is, because some of the stuff is treading in new waters when you're starting to combine some of these diet principles. Plant-based diet, we looked at those a little bit more in detail earlier. The vegetarian, which may include some eggs, it may include some honey, it might include some dairy. Vegan, which excludes all animal products. People who do vegetarian or vegan from an ethical perspective are much different than people who do it from a health perspective. People who do it from an ethical perspective will not, you know, take any vitamin D that's from lanolin, will not look at any of that, because they're doing it for the treatment of the animals, the bees, etc. But I always tell people who are vegetarian, if you're doing vegetarian for ethical reasons, you really should go vegan, because the treatment of animals for taking their eggs and their milk is not always that ethical. If you are going to be eating any animal products at all, they really should be pastured, and they should be organic and all that sort of stuff. Here's my take, and this is my personal opinion, but from a perspective of looking at the physiology and how those foods work in the body, if someone is saying, well, I want to be vegan, I want to be plant-based, but I want to include some animal products, it wouldn't be eggs and it wouldn't be dairy for me, because those are so high on the allergen lists. And dairy has a really bad track record when it comes to cancers and other kinds of imbalances, insulin resistance. So I would say I would rather, if you want to include some animal product with it, have a small amount of maybe some deep ocean fish or some wild buffalo or some kind of wild animal that hasn't grown on the crap. Truth of the matter is, the world can't support people eating large amounts of meat. If everybody ate the kind and the quality of the meat that they needed to eat to maintain health, which is all that pastured organic, if everybody did that, we'd run out of space for pasture land, because it takes a whole lot more pasture land to grow those guys. So you really have to think about it in terms of the planet and the person, and have them, if they need animal products because of wherever their physiology is, or they need it because of their mental, you work with getting them on the minimum that's going to do them good, so it's going to provide those nutrients. And I'm not speaking from a dogma perspective here, because I've been vegan for 31 years and it works well for me, but not all my clients and patients are vegan, nor do I push them to be. I tell them the pros and the cons, and they make their choices. Okay. Then there's the raw vegan, which we mentioned earlier, where it's everything's raw, hopefully germinated and living. And the distinction between a living foods diet and a raw foods diet is the incorporation of these living foods, like fermented foods and foods that have been germinated. And again, we'll go through more. We'll have a whole section on plant-based diets. We're going to have a whole section on all of these so we can go into details with the pros and the cons and the whens and the whys and the wherefores. We talked about macrobiotic, but it's not necessarily a plant-based diet. It's plant-strong diet. People eat fish on a macrobiotic diet. There's a diet called the 80-10-10 diet, which is a raw vegan diet, and it's 80% carbohydrate. So it's a complete opposite of something like a paleo diet or a diet like the zone or ketogenic. It's 80% carb. Now, some people do it where that's just a license to eat 30 bananas a day or, 15 mangoes, and they just load up on lots of fruit. There are ways to do that in such a way that you balance it with green, because I believe that most people that eat it in a way where it's mostly fruit eventually get into trouble. Now, some of them have their teeth go bad because of the lack of minerals, because fruit doesn't have that much minerals. But if you're doing 80% carbohydrate, but you're doing a ton of green leafy vegetables and non-starchy vegetables along with the fruits, and then a small amount of nuts and seeds and a small amount of protein. And I think that if you're going to follow an 80-10-10 type diet where there is a lot of fruit in there, just go ahead and test blood sugar. And if your blood sugar maintains with it, more power to you. There's nothing wrong with eating fruit. Fruit is amazing, but it's not for everyone. And I know that there are people out there who are saying, no, this is the diet for everybody. Everybody should follow it. Again, it's dogma, right? Religion. And we're trying to get away from that. We're going to find out how much fruit. People say to me, oh, you're anti-fruit. I said, no, I'm not anti-fruit. I'm into eating as much fruit as my body will comfortably tolerate. I ate a lot of fruit when I traveled to Hawaii, but I balanced it. I would drink a quart of smoothie and have all these extra greens that I was eating while I was eating my fruit, and I could keep my blood sugar balanced that way unless I overdid it on the fruit. And again, it goes back to the physiology, the biochemistry, the genetics. Personally, I have family history of a lot of heart disease and diabetes, and I have genetics for it, so I have to be more careful. Somebody who doesn't have that doesn't have to be as careful, and they can eat as many mangoes a day as they want. I'm jealous. And then there's the opposite end of that is another raw-based diet called the Rainbow Green Diet that Dr. Gabriel Cousins put together. And his is really geared towards antifungal, anti-candida, and anti-diabetes. And so it's very low in fruit, and he has phase one, a phase one and a half, and a phase two. His phase one is either no fruit or maybe a few blueberries. And then you move into phase two, and you can add some extra stuff like grapefruits and kiwis and things like that, and then the stage two. So you're basically easing your body away. You're getting away from those things that could cause fermentation, that could cause blood sugar imbalances, and then you gradually add them back in. And depending, when people do reintroduction after elimination, some people can add things back, other people can't. So the whole purpose of this presentation is to give you an overview of the various food religions, the various food principles, and then we'll take a deeper dive into each of these as we go through this module. Then there's the diets that go with the specific macronutrient ratios. There's the high-carb diets like the Doug Graham. So some of these diets you're going to find in different... Yeah, so you're going to find these in different places, like they'll fit into different categories. So the 80-10-10 diet is a diet that is very high carb, the one we just talked, 80% carb, 10% fat, 10% protein. The McDougal diet is a high carbohydrate diet, and it's like fat is bad. You want to keep the fat to under 10%. A fruitarian diet is a very low-fat diet because there's no added fat. There's just fruits, although avocados are fruits and can be incorporated in that. Then there's the opposite, which is the low carbs, right? We talked about Atkins. We talked about Zone. Barry Sears talks about it being 40% carb, 30% fat, 30% protein, right? So they're being very specific. I personally think that telling somebody to eat a certain percentage of macronutrients like that, it drives people nuts because there's no way they're going to know that. There's no way to know that. You might think you're eating 80% carb, but really you're getting more fat or protein than you think. Because the green leafy vegetables, if you eat enough of them, you can get a lot of protein. And you could easily bump up to 20% by eating a lot of greens. Is that bad? Oh, not unless you have oxalate problems or some other problems with the components, sulfur problems. So there's a lot of these different things. There's one called the carb night solution, which is 30% carb, 50% fat, and 20% protein. So that's getting towards ketogenic, but not quite there. And then there's the ketogenic, which is the ultra low carb, which is less than 10% carb, 70 to 80% fat, and less than 20% protein. Okay, so these are different ways to look at it. There's other things that there's other diets that are trendy. They come and they go. I remember one of my clients saying to me, "Oh, there's this macro balance diet where you're supposed to target for the specific amount of the macros." And it's hard to follow that. You know, I'm really into having people learn what works for them and then just doing it. And, you know, it might turn out to be, if you calculated it, that it was this percent or that percent. But I think it's really important that we work with people where they're at. Then there's the diets that are avoiding particular chemical constituents. Okay? So we've got things like SCD, specific carbohydrate, and GAPS, the gut and psychology diet. And these are looking at the saccharides, the disaccharides, as being not so hot for the body. So the disaccharides are causing, you know, gut overgrowth or gut bug overgrowth. So these diets are, these diets tend to be, the way they're written, tend to be high in animal protein and low in carbohydrates. But very specific. They have very specific lists. Now, here's the thing with those lists. They still have a lot of crap on their lists of good stuff. I went through that and I'm like, really? Bourbon? I mean, seriously? Are you kidding me? So I went through those diets and I created my own specific carbohydrate where I removed the questionable foods and I made them more plant-based, and people, you know, the meats don't have problems with those, so you can add meat to it if you want to, organic, etc. FODMAP stands for fermentable oligodimonosaccharides and polyols. Okay, so the FODMAPs eliminate a lot of those foods that have oligo, which is longer chain carb saccharides, di, which is two sugar molecules together, and mono. So whereas SCD just is eliminating some of the dyes and the longers, this one's eliminating all of them, plus the polyols, which are sugar alcohols. The idea behind it is that you're feeding your gut bugs, and that when you have dysbiosis in the gut, these foods, your body can't break it down because of the interference of gut bugs. Some people just don't have the right nutritional mechanism, the right physiology to break down these foods efficiently. We've also got low oxalates. Oxalates are chemicals found in a lot of our green leafy vegetables and things like chia seeds, some of the nuts and seeds. Low oxalate tends to be a high diet, hard diet to follow, but folks who have things like vulvodynia, which is unexplained pelvic pain in the vulva area in women, and things like kidney problems where the crystals form in the kidneys and can damage the kidneys, can cause a formation of oxalate kidney stones. So low oxalate diet, we're going to look at that in a lot of detail, the pros and the cons. It's a hard one to do, but it's a deal. You can have someone who has had joint pains or some sort of systemic inflammatory kind of condition for years go on a low oxalate diet and have it clear up in weeks. And so the point is not to just remove these offending pieces, it's to fix the underlying physiology and biochemistry and mechanism so that we can add these things back in. A lot of these things have some genetic component to them. So you can't change your genetics, but you can change the epigenetic expression of them. So then there's phenols, salicylates, and amines, which were first found by Feingold and is also in a diet called the Failsafe Diet, where these things need to be eliminated or minimized due to the impact they have on the brain. And these guys work with, or Feingold work with ADD children, children with hyperactivity. And he found that when you get them low in these foods, and there's a list you'd look up, and we'll provide those later. Anti-yeast, antifungal diets, right? Those low fruit, the ones where you're just trying to kill off and starve away the fungus and the yeast, like the body ecology diet. I like the body ecology diet a lot because it's very, balanced. She uses a lot of the principles of yin and yang, of macrobiotics and 80-20 rule. It's a cooked diet versus Gabriel Cousins' Rainbow Green, which is more raw. Body ecology includes more of the animal products, and Gabriel Cousins doesn't, but it's always in this 80-20 rule. We want 80% alkalizing foods. We want 80% plant foods. We want 80% foods that are going to be, out of low in toxicity. So she's got all this 80-20, which I like, and that was founded by Donna Gates. We talked about the ketogenic, but specifically we're eliminating a particular chemical constituent called carbohydrates, and that's why I threw it in here as well. Low histamine. Foods that naturally contain histamines can trigger a histamine reaction, right? And we all have had a histamine reaction when the nose starts to run and the eyes start to run. Well, there are people who say to you, every time I eat this food or that food, my eyes start to run or my skin breaks out. They're having a histamine reaction. That's abnormal. We shouldn't have histamine reactions to the food. It's usually a result of being deficient in a specific enzyme called diamine oxidase, and it breaks down the histamines. And a lot of people are low in that because of genetic issues. So low histamine diet can help people. And there's lists online where you can look and say, oh, these foods are high, these foods are low. And with any of these, we can do a trial with our clients to remove the oxalates, remove the carbs, remove the histamines, right? Remove the sugars, obviously. Remove the phenols, depending on how they're presenting. Sulfur, low sulfur. Sulfur is found in garlic and onions and brassica vegetables. And so when people say to you, oh, well, I don't do well with garlic or onion. I get headaches or I feel nauseous or I feel bad. Well, they may have a sulfur problem. And their sulfur problem, again, like everything else, can be related to genetics. Areas called the CBS area, which actually is a pathway. It's an enzyme that breaks down the homocysteine down into the cystathionine and then down into glutathione eventually. So people have trouble with sulfur metabolism. Instead of having that pathway intact, they might be making more sulfates and sulfites, which cause them to have allergic type reactions, and they don't handle things that have sulfur in them very well. And then there's the alkaline diet, and we look at that for bone health, we look at that for anti-cancer and for so much else. And that's really looking at 80% residue of the diet is alkaline, 20% is acid, and that's a healing diet as well. So there's a lot of these, and like I said, we're not just like, oh, let's put a person on all of these diets, right? If you removed everything that all these diets said were not going to work, then nobody would eat anything anymore. And that's not a good idea either, is it? All right, so let's look at hypoallergenic and elimination diets. I always put people on a trial a bit, as long as they'll let me, but at least 2 to 3 weeks of gluten-free, dairy-free, soy-free, sugar-free, egg-free, gluten, dairy, corn-free, and egg, soy. So gluten, dairy, corn, soy, eggs, peanuts, and then sugar. And phenomenal results happen with that. A lot of people are gluten intolerant. There are a lot of genes that predispose to that. There are early exposures. There's the fact that they were given, practically in utero, were given these gluten-containing foods. Kids are given these teething biscuits at 4 months old when they start to show signs of teething, and they're all full of gluten and sugar, and it can disrupt the gut flora. Bouts of antibiotics, will affect the gut in such a way that it makes it more difficult to break these proteins down. So we have gluten-free diets, we have casein-free diets. You see a lot of talk about the GFCF diet, gluten-free, casein-free, used a lot with autistic kids. And then the soy-free, and soy is hard, but it can be anything free, right? It can be whatever it is that your client is reacting to. I don't care if it's broccoli, if they're having an adverse allergenic reaction, we need to remove it at least temporarily. And you always have to remember that removing the foods is not solving the problem. It's just making it so you're not aggravating it anymore. It's really fixing and rebalancing the underlying chemistry and physiology that we need to be moving towards. So going into more detail on the low glycemic diets, we have the body ecology, we have the antifungal, we've got the rainbow green, we've got the specific carbohydrate and GAPS. These are all low in sugars. And this is how Donna shows it, Donna Gates, the alkaline-forming foods, the acid-forming foods. I love her 80-20 rule, okay? So those are the food religions. And like I said, we will have more in-depth presentations that take you through a process of knowing, is this a diet that I want to put someone on? Is it not? What are the pros? What are the cons? What are the signs that I want to look for that tell me that I really should maybe go on a trial of a low histamine diet with this person, or a low phenol diet, or a low oxalate diet? So it's really going to be here to help you to make decisions. And the more familiar you get and the more you have little cheat sheets and checklists in order to be able to do it, the easier it's going to be for you to help your clients. So instead of using dogma, like I belong to the macrobiotic religion, instead of just using science, like, oh, this food has this chemical constituent, we want to use food principles, healthy food principles, combined with science, combined with knowing the person's personal history, their genetics, their exposures, their culture, and come up with the personalized nutrition plan based on their biochemical individuality, where they are in their life phase. Are they a teenager? Are they elderly? Are they a kid? What kind of previous traumas they have, because that'll impact what they need in terms of the things like the anti-inflammatory herbs, the fatty acids, the collagen support, things that were required to help them to heal. There are exposures. If someone's living in a very toxic environment, they're going to need a very different diet plan than someone who's living at the top of a mountain in a pristine area. Genetics play a huge role. I mentioned just a couple of SNPs. The DAO SNP is one. There's a lot of the CYP SNPs, which control liver phase 1 enzyme reactions. There's glutathione genes. There's all sorts of genes that play in to how well the body detoxifies the environment, metabolizes their food. And so that plays in. Gender plays in. So males need different from females. An athlete would need maybe a different set of nutrients, maybe more protein, maybe more antioxidants than a non-athlete. Men are different from women. Men have no menstrual cycles and don't necessarily get depleted of some of their blood every month and lose some of their nutrition that way. Preferences have to play in when you're sitting with somebody. You can't design a diet and they go, I don't think I could eat this. It doesn't look good. It doesn't seem like it'll taste good. You've got to really take that in, and what's their ethnic preference? What's the texture preferences that they have? What do they like to chew? Do they like to chew? Do they like to drink? Do they like things that have crunch? Do they like things that are smooth? So you can help to design their diet with them when you know their preferences. And then, of course, the activity level. If you get somebody who's training for a marathon or some sort of intense exercise competition, and they're eating a certain way, they have to get a certain amount of calories, and they've just really got to pack it in. And then 2 months later, they finish it, and they're laying on the beach doing nothing. They're going to have to adapt their food, not just in the amount of the food, but in the macronutrient ratios and the micro. Because somebody who's very, very active and doing a lot of activity is causing some oxidative stress on their body, and you want to make sure that the diet is there to support them through that. So, some basics of sound nutrition that we can all agree on, mostly. There's not going to be any group that's going to agree with everything, but I think these are some good starting points to build upon. You don't want to build your diet on a fast food pizza and frozen food regime. You want to build the diet and customize it based on some strong foundations. So the strong foundations of a good healthy diet would be that the food is whole, the food is fresh. The overall balance is plant strong, meaning the meat doesn't overpower, the dairy doesn't overpower, the bread doesn't overpower, because I think of bread as not really a plant food because we've just fractured it so much. Plant strong, nutrient dense. Where else are you going to get your nutrients except from your food? You certainly don't want to have to sit around and eat the food out of a, or get your nutrients out of a bottle. Yeah, you're going to need to, and you're going to need to help people to figure that out. And I like to look at those as temporary, hopefully. Should be organic as much as possible to avoid all the pesticides, and especially with all this hullabaloo about GMO labeling, they're not allowed to label GMO foods. So you don't know if your food is GMO unless it's certified organic, because they cannot say it's certified organic unless it has not been through the GMO process. So the only way you guarantee that you're getting food that's not GMO, unless you're calling and making a relationship with the person in the lab, then it's not going to be what you think. So essential fats, and this is where some people might disagree on the 80-10-10, the McDougal plans, those plans that are extreme low fat, we need to have a certain amount of fat in the diet to support the mitochondrial function, to support the gut, to support the brain, to support neurotransmitters. Essential fats are critical. And the diet should be free of things like preservatives and additives and GMOs and a whole bunch more, but that's good for now. So ingredients to avoid, teach your clients to read the labels. These ingredients should not be eaten. Benzoate preservatives like BHT and BHA, are they still around after all these years? Yes, they are. Natural flavor, which is really MSG, high fructose corn syrup, sugar, and all of its relatives, all of its sweet and calorie-specific relatives. So people got on the agave bandwagon a few years back, and everybody was putting agave in their foods and thinking it was healthy. We've had people would justify things like honey or molasses as being good. Well, they might be okay for some people, but they are high glycemic. So sugar and its relatives, they can still raise the blood sugar. They can still raise the hemoglobin A1C. So artificial colors and flavors, everybody should avoid those. Artificial sweeteners, Splenda, aspartame, sucralose. I mean, every time one of those comes out, you've got a new set of symptoms that it causes. Like, guys, get it right. Natural flavors, generally it's MSG. Hydrolyzed vegetable protein generally contains MSG. And then flour, which is really not a whole grain at all. It's just artificially pulled out and broken apart and left you without the fibers and all the extra things you need. There's a bunch of fats that I want you to avoid, teach your clients to avoid. So we're now going through some basic food principles, and we'll start in on some of the food religions on our next presentation. Hydrogenated oil, shortening. These are foods that have been artificially saturated. Shortening is actually naturally saturated, and it clumps. So we've got shortening, olestra. Oh boy, olestra. Olestra can cause fecal incontinence. Do you really want fecal incontinence just so that you can have a low sugar food but still make it feel like you're eating sugar? I mean, a low fat food and feel like you're eating fat with that mouth feel? No, I don't think so. I wouldn't. Brominated vegetable oil. Blah. Canola oil, vegetable oil, without any other saying. Those are usually very hot pressed, and there's no effort made to preserve the integrity. And any oil that's not sold in glass, not cold processed and stored in dark containers or glass, Okay, so you sometimes will see like canola oil on the shelf or safflower oil or sunflower oil. It says it's organic. Well, it doesn't matter if it's organic if you don't follow the guidelines. You want to avoid this? 22 teaspoons a day on average for adults, 30 for kids. Is that affecting their health? People don't even realize how much of it they're eating because it's hidden. There's a great movie that was made. It's called The Sugar, That Sugar Film. And the guy who was following a reasonably healthy diet before that decided to actually see what it would do if he ate a certain amount of sugar every day. And he said, I'm doing it with pure sugar. I can easily do that. He says, no, he had to get it in foods that were otherwise considered healthy. Great movie if you want to watch it. Awesome. We got to get off of it. We got to get the off the other sweet stuff that is treated in the body just like the sugar and is causing a glycemic response. And fun with nourishing foods. These are just some ideas I like to put together. And I want you to, the reason I put this in is to teach you, you got to make it fun for people. You can't just give them lists of rules, eat this, don't eat that. You've got to make it fun for them. I like to make something I call the big bowl, which is just a combination of tons of different raw and cooked vegetables, and make a little sauce for it from coconut, and it's phenomenal. What else? Combination salads. You know, not just your little lettuce and tomatoes, but get creative. Teach them how to be creative. Teach them how to incorporate a lot of vegetables into soups, whether they're raw or cooked. Cooked vegetables with raw sauces and dips. Here's where it's really fun because a lot of people will say, well, I'm not eating all this raw food, and that's fine. I don't mind if you eat cooked vegetables because you might actually get a little bit more nutrition out of them because you're going to eat more of it and it's going to be easier for you to chew. But you don't want to eat cooked fats. So I always have people just steam their vegetables and then make really cool sauces and dressings and things to go over them. And that preserves the quality of the fats. When people eat non-gluten grains, don't just sit down and eat bread or eat pasta. It's make it a big bowl with raw sauces and vegetables on top of the non-gluten grains. I used to do this for the kids because I was like so busy and I'd burn things because I'd forget to turn off the stove, and I would make them a big pot of quinoa. These are growing boys. They needed some grain. Quinoa with vegetables. And I would chop it all up and I put seaweed in there, and then I just let it simmer in the rice maker, rice steamer. They loved it. And then when they came out, then I would make these raw sauces and vegetables, which are real easy to make. You're just putting vegetables in the blender. And finally, just a few basic food principles that you can help your client to get started on one at a time. And then you work out what's the right diet. But these are basic principles, not just of what to eat, but how to eat. It's avoiding a high carbohydrate breakfast because it causes a spike in leptin too soon. Avoiding food allergies and refined foods. Chewing thoroughly. Making sure they drink half their body weight in fluid ounces every day, but not with the meals, preferably a half an hour before or an hour after. Eating an alkalizing diet, so moving them more towards that 80% on the left. Eat an organic food diet so you don't have all those pesticides and herbicides and everything else. Eliminate coffee, alcohol, and sugar. These are things that nobody wants to hear, but you got to do it. Exercise, sleep, and stress balance. Give your body an oil change. And go gluten free. Those are two critical things. And by oil change, I mean having them actually swap out their on their cell membranes, their bad fats for their good ones. Well, you're going to say, how do you do that? I can't get in their body. Well, you can. Most people don't chew their food. Most people just scarf it down. And if there's one thing you can do to help people before they have to make a whole bunch of changes, all these things can happen before they have to make too many changes, and they start to chew their food, it's amazing how much better they feel, not just in the gut, but in the joints, etc. When they drink half their body weight or more in fluid ounces of water, amazing how they feel. When they eat a more alkalizing diet, and I have a really good story about alkalizing diet. I had somebody came in and had years and years and years of knee pain. And she was overweight, and I examined her, and I looked at her knee, and I told her that there was probably some things we could do, but I really wanted her to change her diet. And I thought that an alkaline diet would be less inflammatory, and she'd get some good results with it. Well, I gave her an alkaline acid food chart, and I just said, just eat about 80% of your food from this side, the left side, and 20% from the other side, and see how it goes. Just report back. It was funny because she called me up like 4 days later and said, this can't be. I said, what do you mean? It can't have worked that fast, she said. I said, what do you mean? She says, well, my joint pain, my knee pain's completely gone. And it was shocking. She didn't go and do any major stuff. I didn't tell her what to eat and not eat. I just gave her the sheet and I said, eat 80% from here, 20% from there. And she naturally got her diet, her body more alkalized and incorporated probably more of the nutrients that help support it. Eat organic, we talked about that, eliminate caffeine, sugar, and alcohol. Exercise, sleep, and stress balance needs to happen. And it's really important because people don't realize how much that affects them and how much that affects the way they process their food. You want to give the body an oil change. We talked about that already. Go gluten-free, keep the blood sugars balanced, load up on fresh foods, and load up on vitamin C-rich foods. So this is the end of our basic food principles overview presentation, and we'll continue with more detailed presentations where we're going to give you the pros and the cons of each of the different ways of eating so you can be equipped to really, really help your clients to put together that personalized eating plan.